when I interview Denny Miles, he's always the one who says, is that thing off yet? Because he's the old press guy.
Yeah. I'll try to keep my profanity to a minimum.
It's no problem. Geez, I've heard all sorts of fun things. I'm going to talk to you about the Rajneeshis, but there's things about the Rajneeshis. Jerry Thompson's husband's ex-wife was there. She was a Rajneeshi.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I've forgotten that.
And so, those kinds of things kind of are in there, and it's not relevant to my book at all. But, someday somebody will go through, and there it'll be. Everybody will be gone by that point. But
The interesting thing about that experience, from my perspective, uh-huh. because we were living through it, I think most of the government officials that I worked with thought, this is truly extraordinary. This is, a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And people will, everywhere I went, people wanted to talk about the Rajneeshis.
Yeah.
Today, there's a whole generation of people who've never heard of them,
yeah.
don't know the story, and including my children,
yeah.
Who know it only because of me. And it's interesting how quickly the water washes away the edifices that we are thinking are going to last
forever. Yeah.
Ever.
We find that with our workers in the archives. The student workers are going through stuff. For instance, Bob Oliver gave us all his stuff. Not Jerry. I have Jerry's stuff, but she hasn't decided if she's going to give it to us or not. But I have it for the book. But they're just going through this, and they never heard of them.
Yeah.
And they're just stunned at all this stuff, this community that came up, and then all the ins and outs, and all those things. It's just amazing. Just amazing. So let's start out. Tell me about how you went to work in the Attorney General's office.
I went to law school in California.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to the University of Oregon. Undergrad, and I met my wife while at Oregon, and she was a New Yorker, but we both ended up in Oregon. And after law school, she said, I'll make you a deal, you can take any job you want as long as it's in Oregon. And so I took an appellate clerkship, and I did that for a couple of years. And when my clerkship was over and the judge was kind of kicking me out of the nest, I decided I want to go someplace where I can learn how to try cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the AG's office told me that I'd try my first case the first month I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true. I actually tried my first case on the Friday of the first week that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I accepted the offer, the only thing that I wanted to negotiate on was Mark Nelson, who was the AG's executive assistant at the time,
mm-hmm.
said, we want you to make a 3-year commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I can't do that. I'm only willing to give you a 2-year commitment.
Mm-hmm.
They settled for that, and I left the AG's office 12 years later.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So who was the AG when you started?
Jim Redden.
Jim Redden. Okay.
And I was there for a year or two, I guess 2 years. I came in 78, and then he got appointed to the federal bench.
Yeah.
And the Governor Tia,
mm-hmm.
appointed Jim Brown as the Attorney General. He had to appoint a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to give the Democrat an edge, so he appointed a career professional. Jim had
right.
been a district attorney in Corvallis, but then he went to the appellate division. And when he became attorney general, one of his first official acts was to relieve the solicitor general of his responsibilities. And I was sitting in my little office one day,
mm-hmm.
not yet 30 years old, and he came and knocked on my door and said, would you like to be Solicitor General for 18 months? And the deal was, everybody, most of all me, understood that the new guy was going to choose his own Solicitor General. So I took it knowing it was a up-or-out kind of deal. And that's how I became Solicitor General.
Mm-hmm. So Frohmeyer comes in and decides to leave things the way they are? I mean,
it was there was more involved than that. I had never met Dave Frohmeyer before he was elected.
Mm-hmm.
And a week or two after the election, I attended a meeting of the Executive Committee of the District Attorneys Association.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave came and took his bows with a group that was very supportive of him. And the meeting was in the Department of Justice conference room.
Mm-hmm.
So the meeting broke up about noon, and I went back into my office. And Dave followed me into my office, knocked on the door and introduced himself, and we shook hands, and he said, do you have time to go to lunch? And I, without thinking, said, no, I have a brief I've got to write. And so he looked a little shocked and said, well, okay, and walked away, and I pounded my head against the desk, realizing that the guy that was going to decide my future had...
Right.
I just turned him down for a lunch invitation. The other thing, and I wrote a law review article, actually, that kind of focused on this. Right around the time that Dave was running, the federal court issued a decision in a case called Capps versus Atiyah, which was a prison overcrowding case.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge, Judge Burns, ordered that the state release 750 inmates from Oregon State Prison and Oregon State Correctional Institute by the end of the year, by the end of 1980. Harl Haas, who was running against Dave, responded to that by saying, we've got to build more prisons. Dave responded to it by saying, that decision is just flat wrong, and when I'm Attorney General, I'll appeal it and I'll get it reversed.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was the AG-elect, he was facing the fact that he made this commitment and the prisoners were going to be on the street before he ever took the oath of office. So he worked pretty closely with myself and Jim Mountain, who was my deputy solicitor, in crafting the briefs and doing all of that. And it gave me an opportunity to work closely with the new guy and gave him an opportunity to get comfortable with me. And so he decided to keep me around for a while.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever have lunch?
We had lunch many times, but I never made up for that one.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were in the AG's office before Frohmeyer took office, what were your interactions with the governor's office?
None.
Okay.
I may have had contact with Bob Oliver or Jerry. I don't think I had met the governor before I was the solicitor.
Mm-hmm.
And
It would have been with Lee Johnson. Jerry didn't come in until the fall of 1981.
That's right. That's right.
So
I'd forgotten about Lee.
The former attorney general.
Right. I did have dealings with Lee Johnson, now that you mention it, because I had never obviously not worked with him when he was the AG,
right.
But he was kind of a legendary figure in government circles, having significantly reorganized the AG's office when he did. So I don't think I met Governor Atiyah until 1982.
Okay.
Yeah. It would have been in connection with the prison overcrowding cases.
Yeah. When do you recall that the Rajneeshis first came to your attention? They're here kind of late summer of 81. They're buying property. Thousand Friends of Oregon fairly quickly says land use.
Right.
And there's all sorts of things going on there. And I've got Atiyah would have weekly meetings of his department heads and
yes.
the others. And fairly quickly, somebody said, hey, there's this thing going on out there that we need to pay attention to. Nobody knew what to do with it or what it really was. But when do you kind of recall it getting on your radar?
Well, I think I was kind of generally aware of the fact that there was this group that had come to Oregon from media reports before it ever became anything involving my work.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I remember really honing in on the incredible array of issues that had to be addressed with respect to the Rajneeshis was probably after Stan Long came and became Dave's deputy, and Marla Ray was his press person and executive assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have, we called them fallout drills. Every morning, the group, the AG's immediate staff would get together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes as solicitor, I would attend those meetings. And it seemed like every time I went to those meetings, Marla was giving an update on what it was like on the ground in Central Oregon, because her parents lived in Gateway and she was really wired into the Madras community, which was pretty impacted by then. And so she would kind of report on what the word was that folks were talking about over there. And it became apparent very quickly that we had a very significant risk of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, armed people firing guns, because you had a very armed Rajneesh peace force, and you had farmers and ranchers who were not happy by having these folks in town. So I remember being very concerned almost from the first time that I was aware that there were issues, that this needed to be handled with some care because it could get away from us.
Yeah, yeah. As time went on, as you said, there's just a whole host of issues going on. Do you remember any special things going they had these summer festivals? Which were big land use things, but also big coordination among different groups. I've got minutes from the meetings of the sheriff here, the sheriff there, the state police, you know, all these kinds of things. Do you remember your office being involved in those kinds of things?
Yes, and in about 1983, I became the deputy AG.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I started attending the governor's weekly, they called them cabinet meetings, but it was the agency heads.
Yeah.
And it seemed like just about every week the issue of the Rajneeshis came up. And I was aware from that point forward about the increased security concerns when you brought thousands of people to the site, and the fact that there were people claiming that that was itself illegal and so forth. It was right around that time that I remember being in a briefing with our criminal justice folks who were talking about tactical issues, like the fact that Rajneeshpuram was a kind of a box canyon, and they had to think in terms of how can we go in and effect arrests or enforce search warrants if the time comes without putting a great many people's lives in peril. And anytime you add people to the mix, more people, then the concerns become that much greater.
Yeah.
So,
It's interesting. By the end, basically in kind of August, September, Sheila leaves in September of 85. The Bhagwan is finally arrested in October of 85. The governor had the National Guard with live ammunition doing maneuvers up on the Rim Rock. And you know, just like, whew, just in case.
Well, and for probably 18 months before the thing kind of blew up,
mm-hmm.
There, really from the date that the Attorney General issued his opinion on mm-hmm. the illegality of
right.
Rajneeshpuram under the First Amendment, when that happened, and I don't remember the date, it just escalated everything.
Mm-hmm.
They started deciding, well, then we've, you know, their land use efforts weren't going really well, and now they had this other threat that
mm-hmm.
they couldn't land use regulate their way around, and we started seeing more desperation, like the, you know, bringing homeless people in
right.
to try to control the county, and their efforts to poison residents, they weren't trying to kill them, they were trying to keep them from the polls
yeah.
so that they could dilute the vote of the non-Rajneeshis. And sometime in that area, we began to have twice daily telephone calls, and on the call there was Jerry Thompson, Governor Attia, Dave, me, Charlie Turner, the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
attorney,
mm-hmm.
and the head of the Oregon State Police.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that calls often would last no more than 5 minutes. It was just a touch base, anybody
right.
have anything they need to report.
Yeah.
But there was, the level of concern was so great for quite a number of months
yeah.
that it seemed, from where I sat, pretty all-consuming.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't the one that was going to make the call to send the National Guard in.
Mm-hmm.
But it nevertheless was a pretty heavy-duty time.
Yeah. As you're going through this, I mean, you're in the AG's office, which is an independent elected body of Oregon, and then there's the governor's office, an independently elected thing. How does that work? Are you guys coming up with your own strategies and then talking about them with the governors? Is the governor kind of saying, let's do this, and you're working within that framework? I mean, how does that come together as you're thinking about it?
We had different roles,
mm-hmm.
and I think I learned a lot about how attorneys ought to interact with their clients by watching Dave and Vic in their respective roles.
Mm-hmm.
Both were very respectful of the other's authority,
mm-hmm.
and it's a little different. The arrangement in the AG's office is different than in private practice, because all of my clients can decide today that they don't like me or they don't like
right.
the advice I'm giving them and go get different lawyers. The governor and his agency heads didn't have that choice. They
yeah.
were stuck with the Attorney General. And so we recognized, and I think the governor recognized, that he was responsible for public policy, and we were responsible, the AG was responsible, for legal policy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really blurry line.
Yeah.
Anybody that tells you that they can make the distinction between the two
right.
with any consistency is just not being honest. But it was a pretty good guideline. And we were involved in literally dozens of issues where agencies were asking us pretty complicated legal questions. And it wasn't just the governor. The Secretary of State,
mm-hmm.
Norma Paulus, had to deal with all of the election issues. And we had an entire task force of assistant AGs who were working on dealing with, you know, questions of how do you deal with these homeless people that are trying to get
mm-hmm.
registered to vote, and just an incredible array of issues in that regard. And we had questions from the state police and the Board of Police standards and trainings mm-hmm. about certification of their peace officers.
Mm-hmm. I got your letter on that right here.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Education, we worked with Vern Duncan, who was the superintendent of public instruction, and like Norma, a separately elected official.
It's your letter to the chief of police of Portland saying, so what's the deal with the peace force,
yeah.
and how do we get them in and or deal with them and all that stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that stuff that
yeah.
that the governor's office just never really got involved in. It was
yeah.
handled more at the agency head level.
Yeah.
And where the governor, of course, we didn't ask him if he thought our opinion on the church-state issue
mm-hmm.
was right, but
mm-hmm.
we sure made sure that he was in the loop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wrote a letter to you like the day he got it, saying, go.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. Do you remember the genesis of that letter, that opinion?
Not really. Somebody asked for an opinion.
Yeah.
I don't even remember who it was.
Jerry remembers there, because there were, you know, you had these meetings all the time, but she remembers in maybe August or September, there was just tossing around ideas kind of thing. And it may have come from AG side people who were in a meeting. But then it turned into the opinion. So,
do you remember who the requester was? It might have been a state legislator.
I don't. I don't.
But I just don't remember how it came up. I spent quite a bit of time working on that opinion,
mm-hmm.
And I handled the case that we filed to validate it, but. I just don't remember how it came up.
Yeah. On the opinion itself and the repercussions of it, in fact, you spell it out right here in this letter about the Peace Force. Down at the bottom here, you're talking about, so should they be going to the police academy and that kind of stuff, the Peace Force? Until the issue is finally resolved, we have endeavored in so as far as possible to maintain the status quo with respect to all aspects of the community's legal status. And yet there's a decision to cut off funds to them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you walk me through why that decision was made, even though all this was pending, going through the courts and eventually was federal?
Well, let me...
This is guns and peace force training.
Right.
So the paragraph I just read you starts on the previous page, and this is the end of it right up here.
Well, I think that there were two issues. When I said maintain the status quo, and you can see in there, I'm talking about don't go back and try to decertify people that
right.
you've certified. Don't try to collect money that has already been paid. That was a different question than
okay.
should the government be writing a check.
A new check. Okay.
And it was our view that the Constitution was pretty clear
mm-hmm.
that you couldn't...
Down there, no money shall be.
Yeah. I mean, the religion clauses of the Oregon Constitution are actually much more specific than
mm-hmm.
the United States Constitution, particularly on the Establishment Clause
mm-hmm.
side.
Mm-hmm.
And so we concluded that, you know, our advice was this city is unconstitutional. They're not entitled to share revenue.
Mm-hmm.
If we have our client give them a check, we are advising our client to violate that constitutional provision.
Okay.
On the other hand, we had, it was Dave's judgment that we couldn't just issue the opinion and then sit back,
mm-hmm.
that it was a weighty enough matter because it involved not only the Establishment Clause issue, but free exercise issues.
Mm-hmm.
We thought it was weighty enough that we needed to involve the court.
Yeah.
So we simultaneously announced, when we issued our opinion, that we were going to file a declaratory judgment action. And we did that fairly quickly. And our view was they're free to go to the court and ask the court to order us to write a check.
Mm-hmm.
If they, you know, if we cut off their revenue sharing and they think we're wrong.
Right.
There's a procedure available to them, and that way we are being consistent with our opinion in the advice that we give, and they can have ask a judge to overrule us, which they never did.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the best I can piece
together. No, that's good. Now. That's good. Because we have an almost immediate response. Well, as soon as they figure out, they ask for a check and it doesn't come.
Yeah.
And then KD, the mayor, writes and says, but it says the court has to decide or there has to be a law, and that hasn't happened. It's just an opinion. But this makes it very clear the way you were looking at it. So that's great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
You brought it up in the answer you just gave. The governor himself was really reticent to clamp down, A, because you have to see laws have been violated, and B, he was really conscious of religious freedom kinds of issues, as well as what you started out with, the right to keep and bear arms, and there were a lot of guns driving around in pickup trucks. Were you in the AG's office, were you looking at those kinds of things or taking them into account, the religious freedom kinds of balances?
Yeah, absolutely. The folks in the AG's office that were deeply involved in these issues, I can say without exception, bore no animus toward Rajneeshis, and
mm-hmm.
and I think had varying opinions about, you know, what they thought about that
right.
community. But Dave was always focused on that balance between the government's strict neutrality in the face of religious diversity
mm-hmm.
and the right of anyone to pursue really diverse or even bizarre religious practices
mm-hmm.
so long as it wasn't requiring that the government provide support for it.
Right.
So we were all about, you know, in fact, I worried a lot when we were drafting the church-state opinion, and I think the opinion discusses it, that if it was true, as Thousand Friends contended, that they couldn't have a commune on the Big Muddy Ranch because mm-hmm. it needed to be incorporated as a city.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were right that they couldn't incorporate it as a city because it violated mm-hmm. the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
then it seemed to me maybe they could argue that they were entitled under the Free Exercise Clause
mm-hmm.
to be exempted from the application of the land use law that required them to be a city.
Yeah.
And the way the case unfolded, those issues never got resolved
right.
because shortly after Judge Fry issued her decision upholding the AG's opinion, the whole thing unraveled
right.
and it was gone 6 months later.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. When I talked to Bob Oliver and was pressing him on this, because he wrote, similar to you guys, he was writing saying, well, police forces can have heavy weaponry. They have a lot more than even the city of Portland, but it's well within, at the same time as funds were being prevented from going there. And the way he viewed it was that even if it's a church, churches have the right to keep and bear arms as well as anybody else. Then it becomes an issue of, so are they a city, so can they have these types of weapons or not? But for him, it was an open question, and the guns were a different thing than the funding, as he was understanding it.
Sure, and you know, the Second Amendment, the state of law on the Second Amendment was different back then
mm-hmm.
than it is today. I don't
mm-hmm.
know that their possession of semi-automatic weapons today would have been viewed as a question of well, are they a valid police right. force? They could have just been a group of concerned citizens.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people would say, well, they have perfect right to carry those guns and mm-hmm. and more.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember Bob being particularly sensitive to protecting the rights of the Rajneeshis.
Mm-hmm.
And in any meeting, if someone was going to push back on some planned action or
mm-hmm.
refusal to act,
mm-hmm.
it was likely going to be Bob just asking the questions, are we sure that we're not trampling on minority rights here?
Right, right. In the fall of 1984, there is kind of a come to Jesus meeting where Jerry has all the state heads, you're there, Dave Frohnmayer's there, Norm is there, all the federal people, and they all meet over in the AG's conference room so that people don't see them wandering around the Capitol building. And in that meeting, she says that she yelled. I don't know if she did or not, but she made it really clear that, especially on the feds, they needed to be reporting what was going on so that there was a central clearinghouse about what was happening about the Russian issues. Do you remember that meeting?
Not specifically, but that, I mean, I don't doubt that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, in particular, was, I think, tasked by the governor with trying to make sure that there was good coordination.
Mm-hmm.
She was frequently would check in with me and Dave just to say, you know, do you know what Charlie's up to? And I think there was a lot of concern. I mean, there always are turf issues between the feds and the state.
Yeah.
But in this in particular, you know, if you think about it, we wanted to make sure that the U.S. attorney didn't execute a raid, and we
right.
read about it in the paper. Because
right.
I think all of us felt a great sense of responsibility to the state
mm-hmm.
to try to do our best to make this turn out right.
Right.
And that requires control.
Yeah.
And I think it may well be that meeting that you describe was what gave rise to the twice daily conference
mm-hmm.
calls that I described.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it. Were you involved in giving any opinions or talking to the state police about their infiltration efforts in getting people into the Rajneeshi Quorum?
Not that I recall.
Okay. Because they had an official post. But
mm-hmm.
they also had people who were scattered hither, thither, and yon
mm-hmm.
There.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Okay. One of the issues that came up is when, especially this meeting with the feds and then other meetings that came afterwards, it's clear that different Fed groups said, well, if only we were in there. They weren't doing any of that. Because the state police got an order fairly early, January 82, as far as we can tell. Atiyah said, get in there.
Interesting.
So,
mean, I may have known that and forgotten,
mm-hmm.
but if I didn't know it, it is a good indication of how closely that information was held.
Yeah.
Because I would have assumed that I would know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Jerry knew it was happening, but didn't know anybody who was involved. There's a crucial meeting between Jerry and Sheila. It's the only time they meet. And they set it up here in the state building. And so it's kind of late-ish at night. And so Jerry is driven up by General Miller and, just based on his name, the head of the state police, mentioned earlier, and a driver. And as they're pulling out of the Capitol in the car, this car stops, the window rolls down. Williams is the guy. And Williams, this homeless guy, comes up and asked for a cigarette, and Williams gives him a cigarette and rolls the window up, and Jerry said, what on earth was that? And it was one of their inside people from Rajneeshpuram who was passing along the latest information. I just like, this is just... I have a friend who was a longtime station head in the CIA, and I told him that, and he said, they read our playbook.
That's funny.
It's just amazing stuff there. As the Rajneeshis came to an end, did the tensions hit you guys, aside from the biweekly phone calls? One thing that's happening during this time, so we're into 84 and 85, and this hits Jerry really hard. This is when the governor decides that he needs to go find business all over the world. So he's traveling a lot.
Yeah.
And he and Jerry decided that one of them always had to be in Salem because of the Rajneeshis. So actually, she took one of the international trips and went to Taiwan. But he was traveling a lot. And so the internal pressure on her was just getting immense.
That was a very tense time for all of us, I think. I vividly recall getting a phone call from Jerry 11 o'clock one night, and she said, you need, and she woke me up, and she said, you need to get on a call right now. The Rajneeshis have several vans full of homeless people, and they are dropping them off in the Dalles, and they are flashing automatic weapons.
Yes, indeed.
And we got on the phone and talked about, you know, what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But there were more than a few of those kinds of late night calls.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that is not, I don't, you probably know it. You've done your homework, obviously, but we had some pretty high-level settlement talks with the Rajneeshis mm-hmm. around this time, and in particular, ironically, there was a meeting that was held in the governor's conference room with J.D. Mm-hmm. and Swami Prem Naren, who was their chief lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and Jayananda, who mm-hmm. was Sheila's husband,
right.
And always had a kind of a, I was never quite sure what his status in the organization was.
Yeah.
And what they wanted was to find a way that would satisfy us that they could continue to have their commune and not violate the Establishment Clause. And I remember walking in, and they, you know, we did all the pleasantries and everything. And for some of these folks, like Naren, you know, I'd seen him in court maybe once
mm-hmm.
or twice mm-hmm. and had communications with him, but we never had face-to-face meetings. And
yeah.
So there was a fair amount of pleasantries exchanged and getting to know each other. And then they said, okay, let's cut to the chase. What do you need?
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to do to get you into this car today? And I said, you have to really, truly, actually give up control of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a long silence, and Jayananda said, that can never happen. And that was the end of the discussion.
Yeah.
Around that time, and this was, you know, the times get foggy
well,
in
yeah.
my head, but
it's a 4-year period as well. So
yeah, it was right around this time that we were getting ready to go argue the church-state case
mm-hmm.
before Judge Fry,
mm-hmm.
and I think they had figured out that they were in trouble in that case, and there was all this stuff swirling around, and all of a sudden Sheila was much more visible in Portland and
mm-hmm.
was on the television a lot more,
mm-hmm.
and I think we know now that she was facing some significant internal dissent, but at the time we didn't know what was going on. We just knew that the temperature was rising. And I went and argued the case before Judge Fry, and we got a ruling immediately. And after the hearing, I was packing up my bags, and I had a big banker's briefcase with all my files. And as I was walking out the door, Sheila came running over and said, "Oh, Mr. Gary, let me hold the door for you." And she opened the door, and I walked through it, and she stuck her foot out, and I tripped and fell flat on my face, which caused all of the Rajneeshis that were there, and there were a lot of them, to just burst out into laughter. And I remember walking out saying, "I've probably fallen on my face in court many times, but that's the first time it's ever actually been literally true."
Right. So, yeah. It's just wild.
Yeah, it was something. It was something.
Yeah.
And you know, I thought, well, that's just the way government work is. It's always like this.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Most of Vic's legislative career, there's some fun things in there, but it's taxes. And then when he's governor and the recession hits, it's taxes again.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, how do I make this so that it's interesting? And my readers have actually said that I like the tax part the best. It's like, I think you're insane, but whatever.
Well,
you get this stuff.
Let me just say about the taxes. You know, I was a Democrat working for a Republican AG representing a Republican governor.
Mm-hmm.
And again, back in those days, it didn't.
Yeah, it was a very different.
It made perfect sense.
Yeah.
But I watched Vic through three special sessions, each time needing to cut another 5% out of the budget.
Yeah.
And it was cut after cut after cut, and he needed to raise the revenue, and he came up with the $81 million transfer from SAFE, which set in motion an entire saga that went on for decades. But I still vividly remember him getting up in the special session. He was running for re-election.
Yeah, he was running for the head of a special section in session in September of his re-election.
And Kulongoski was running around, you know, as Ted Wood, being affable, and he came up to me and said, "I don't really care. I just hope this session ends in the next hour."
Exactly, got things to do.
But the governor got up and gave a speech, and he said, "You know, I hear people say this is a terrible idea. I hear people say that it's not right. The you know, policy holders and blah de blah." And he said, "And I agree, this is not a good option. My question to all of you is, what is a better option?" It was one of the most effective speeches I've ever heard by anybody, and it was, you know, very, you could tell he was agonizing because he was being forced to do things that went against his fundamental nature, you know. It was one of many reasons why I came to really admire the guy.
Yeah, when I was talking to Hardy Myers, who was speaker, I call it the safe way. He said, "Oh, no. We don't talk about it in those terms. Everybody else does." And the fun part was one of the safe governors was Vic's re-election, Roy Livermore.
Right.
Who was the money guy for Vic in the re-election. And he was ticked off and then came back in the next day and said, "Okay, what are we going to do to win this election?"
Yeah, that was a very interesting saga. It's
a
little drier than Rajneeshi's, but in some ways no less important.
Well, it's going to be, I'm going to write a piece, I don't know what I'm going to do with it, maybe put it in the Oregonian and three people will read it. But the IP-28, the gross receipts tax, is a version of what Vic said we should do in 1982 when he won re-election. His was more on individual taxpayers and businesses, but it was the same idea. And his would have raised $1.5 billion in a biennium, which is in the same general area is the 5 billion that they're talking about with IP28. So it's just fascinating to see how all that politicizes and changes and moves around.
Well, one of the things that I have been struck by going back to those days, and it's ironic because I don't spend a lot of time thinking about them, except it, with Dave's passing recently, I was asked to write a law review article, and so I delved into some of those things from the 80s and now you. And when we talk about, well, he proposed that they transfer $81 million from the Industrial Accident Fund to the General Fund to avert a major budget crisis. We were facing another 5% cut of the General Fund budget, and he balanced the budget with $81 million. I mean, it doesn't sound like very much money now. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing the article and talking about prison overcrowding, and I said, there were going to be 750 inmates released on the streets. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that doesn't sound like very much when you look at the prison population today. Mm-hmm. It was 30% of the total prison population at the time.
Yeah.
And now we've got, 10 times that many people incarcerated. It's remarkable.
Very different thing.
It was when government was small and everybody knew everybody and you could get things done.
Yeah, and one of the fascinating things is, because Vic was in the middle of the revenue side, he never went to Ways and Means. He never spent the money in the legislature. He was raising it. That was where he would spend his time. But he was, because he was in there from 59 until 78, the inflation years took off, and his brain never adjusted to inflation. And so he watched this huge increase from 70 until he became governor. The budget went from maybe $300 or $400 million to like $1.7 billion. And yeah, there's a lot of increase there, but there's a huge inflation arc in that as well.
Yeah.
And he never could get his head around that in terms of how much legislators were paid. To his dying day, he said, they're making $2,000 a month. You can live on $2,000 a month. It's like, who can? but it's just fascinating to get inside his head and look at that and make those kinds of things. So other things while he's governor, were you involved in the Monty Montgomery thing? So the way it's been told to me is, not the details of what Monty did, but when, I can't remember who came over, but came over and briefed Jerry. Jerry said, we have to talk to the governor. And so going into the governor, and the governor is eventually just putting his head in his hands and saying, that's not the Monty that I know.
It was very painful for the governor because they were close. And what Monty did was... he came very close to looking at prison time, in my view. It was just a huge lapse of judgment on his part. And I worked with Stan Long on the investigation and the whole Associated Oregon loggers, the net result of which was AOL had gone off and formed their own insurance company, and when it was all over, SAFE owned AOL's insurance company. We just folded it in to SAFE. And the last act that I had with regard to that saga was Monty and AOL had an accountant by the name of Berkman, Barkman, B-A-R-K-M-A-N. And we concluded that Barkman was helping Monty to do what he did, and so we sued him. Mm-hmm. And SAFE, we tried the case. I ended up losing it on a 9-3 vote by the jury, but it wasn't because they didn't think he had been guilty that was mm-hmm. because, as his lawyer told me, you can never prove that anything an accountant does actually caused you to lose money. That was an important lesson for me. And mm-hmm. I said, well, that's crazy. Of course you can. And he said, no, if you think about it, you know, if your accountant tells you that you don't have to pay taxes and it turns out that you owe the taxes, then you owed the taxes. It's yeah. not, you know, you can yeah. argue about interest. The Monty Montgomery, that was an interesting one.
Yeah. Monty was one of Vic's earliest friends in the legislature. In 1959, there was a group of five of them, and then Bob Smith was elected to the legislature in 61. They were called the Young Turks.
Yeah.
And they made young Governor Hatfield was an honorary Young Turk as well. But Vic kept all of those little message pads that the legislators used to communicate with each other. He kept all of them from his first two terms. And Monty Montgomery is something of a sleazeball. Even then. And there's stories about him when Vic was governor about him basically bragging that he can make the governor do whatever he wants.
Yeah, I think he liked to throw that, you know, impress people with his influence. My favorite Monty Montgomery story is that when he had succeeded in negotiating this contract between mm-hmm. AOL and SAFE, he was the chair of the board at the time, and he came in to sign the contract, came into the SAFE office, and he was wearing a two-billed baseball hat.
Mm-hmm.
And he put it on, and he said, I accept this contract on behalf of AOL, and he signed it. And then he turned his hat around, and he said, I accept this contract on behalf of SAFE, and he signed it.
What a guy.
Yeah.
What a guy.
Yeah. Well, you got to have some arrogance to think, you know, not only am I going to negotiate both sides of the agreement,
right,
but I'm going to do it baldly. You can see my signature on
yeah.
on both sides of the contract.
Yeah, exactly. Let's finish up. You said on the phone that Vicatia was your hero.
Yeah.
Why?
It surprised me that's how I ended up feeling, because he was such a quiet, unassuming person,
mm-hmm.
and yet he had a laser-like ability to focus, and he understood that the role of the governor was to be a leader, not to be a manager.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you one story. I had spent quite a bit of time working with some of my colleagues when I was the deputy on asbestos, and there was a huge problem with asbestos in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And people were starting to bring lawsuits
mm-hmm.
to force the states to do something about the fact that they had this dangerous environmental problem in the schools. And I ended up, the AG ended up recommending that the state bring some lawsuits against Manville and some of the other mm-hmm. big manufacturers. And it was a close call for me, and I was struggling with, do we spend limited state resources on something that is liable to end up being a dry hole,
mm-hmm.
Even if we win, because there may not be any money there,
mm-hmm.
or do we take the risk that we do nothing and then we are faulted
right.
for it? So I wrote a memo to the governor that laid out the options. And a day or two later, I got a call from him, and he said, you know, you can keep me posted on this, but this is all I'm going to say. cover your ass best as you can.
Oh, Victor.
Yeah, indeed.
Yep. Well, great. Well, thank you very much.
What a nice project.
Yeah. It's a blast. Right now, I just nailed down at like 11:30 this morning. It was one of those things when you're doing research, you go, yes! Victor and Tom McCall had a fraught relationship. But I'm finding things about the relationship that no one's ever heard before. McCall was actually not frequent, but an occasional dinner guest over at their house between when Victor was elected in 59 and McCall then went off to be the Secretary of State. So they had a relationship that was not just a political relationship. But after the land use law, SB 100, passed, both of them went back to Washington, D.C., and on that trip, McCall, whose tax plan had just been defeated by the voters overwhelmingly, McCall told Victor that he'd never liked him. And Victor puts it into a context of Tom is Tom, and it does all sorts of wonderful things about Tom being Tom. But trying to figure out, so what was this meeting? Did it actually happen? You know, memories, doing a project like this, memories are all over the place. You got to figure out, so how do I figure this out, make it sense? So I found a one-paragraph piece in the Oregonian from May 1980 or 1973 saying, Governor goes to D.C. tomorrow to talk on land use at the Air and Space Museum. Okay, well, it's as good as anything. And so I follow it up, and lo and behold, doing some other things, I finally came across the Registered Guard had a reporter there. And so Lawrence Rockefeller was appointed by Nixon to have a National Commission on Land Use and Urban Planning. And they both were there talking before this group. And so the context works. It all works. I have the real story.
That's cool.
Now we go off. So it's just fun. Fun, fun, fun. Well, thank you very, very much.
Well, listen, if...